So, first, I think I should confess from where I speak. I'm an art historian. I think I'm the only art historian in the whole program, which is nice, of course, to have crossover approaches. But actually, I'm even worse than an art historian because I'm a modernist art historian, involved particularly with the Arab and Iranian worlds. And eventually, it's fine to be a modernist art historian because I will deal very indirectly with a certain guilt about modernism. I will speak of a further conquest to the conquest of artistic identity, which is that of artistic territory, grounded both in and against modernism. And to be very simple, I will take the Hijaz Railway as the unconscious hypothesis for this territory, as we are invited at this challenging event. So, a Lebanese writer and painter, here is Gebran Tarazi, as you can see him in the 50s and the 60s, in his youth, evolving in the boutique familiale, seemingly happy, reading Jean-Paul Sartre, under the orange and green light of the colored glass lamps shimmering all day above his head. But in reality, he already struggles immensely with his conscience as a craftsman from father to son, trying to find a way out of the artisan fatality in order to become a writer or an artist, which meant for him to transcend and disrupt his Tarazi lineage in order to become Gebran. In the novel that he wrote in 1978, Le Pressoir à Olive, he has violent condemnations of his own roots and the souk as a place for alienation, symbolized as an irrational labyrinth. This is a group of four paintings by Gebran Tarazi by the end of the 90s. But is it in order to exercise this alienation of the labyrinth that some series of his later paintings seem to be reproducing the idea of labyrinth, seemingly abstract, geometrically on the edge of vertigo, indigestible? That series of four paintings done in Beirut from the end of the 90s, but which creative process began for Gebran Tarazi during the growing conflict of the 1970s, almost as an escape and survival to the experience of war. A family of antique dealers, decorators, and interior designers over four generations, the Tarazis progressing from exile to upward mobility and from refuges to utopias left a resonant mark on the 19th and 20th centuries, almost alongside with the development of the Ottoman railways. From Damascus, symbolized by the tragic flight of 1860, indelible stain, to Jerusalem, symbolized by the Jaffa Gate, which became the natural setting for the family shop in the late 19th century, on to Rabat, the breath of life with 1956 independence, its bittersweet aftermath, and Beirut, the cosmopolitan dream of the 1960s, the Baalbek Festival, etc., etc. Street shops. Here you see a view of the Tarazi street and souk shops in Beirut above and Jerusalem below. A network of cities defining a beyond national and country's territories in aspiration for an Eastern empire, an empire of us and no more an empire of them, bridging the national with the transnational and the Euphrates with the Mediterranean. Baghdad, for instance, was a key stop on the Hijaz railways, but not on the Tarazi's galaxy. Baghdad, probably less connected in terms of trans-Arab craft, trade, and circulations of goods than Damascus, Jerusalem, Beirut, and Cairo. Cities weaving and railways juxtaposition of urban fabrics as a geometric figure drawn on the map or a sacred temple traced in the sky. These were the cities chosen by the great grandfather Dimitri Tarazi for the four craft workshops he planned to leave to his 16 children. While Gibran's grandfather took over the one in Damascus, where Gibran was born, his father decided to export the family savoir-faire to Rabat in 1946, after the end of the Second World War. This was the golden age of Gibran's education, as he learned to sneak off into the back streets and peek in on what the craftsmen were doing and experienced the seminal revelation of the clash between the old town and the modern one, a tension that remained at the heart of his explorations in literature and painting, a testimony not only to urban and trade development through the craft, but also to the transitory age of the East, not dreamed by the West anymore, but thanks to the railways, wanderings, and penetrations, the East dreamed by the East. While the connections of ports and routes concurred pave way for a mapping infrastructure, the allegorical space lying between Beirut, Damascus, and Aleppo expands as well with the railways. From this moment of interconnectedness, everywhere the same reorganization of space. As the walls, towers, and old houses were torn down to make way for new thoroughfares, as squares and public spaces were reshaped, and the souks often turned into rows of shops along a pedestrian street, a sign of more European habits and standards that found their exaggerated equivalents or simulacrum in the pavilions of the Oriental countries at the world fairs in colonial metropolises. And here I refer to the outstanding book by Zeynep Çelik, Displaying the Orient. Therefore, the Western dream of the East seems to show persistence, paradoxically based on Eastern economic and infrastructural growth. In his artistic diary and paintings, Tarazi wonders whether, I quote, the dynasties of the East didn't just crumble away like mud walls with the passing seasons, end quote, while playing on the motif of the wall, of the ceiling, of the garden, of the labyrinth, and most probably of the railways in his painting. This is where the Qayyim Nayyim, the universal structure of four rectangles nested in order to form a square shape, appears to revive the fascinating dilemmas of the old and the new city, playing out tensions between openings and closings, angles and diagonals, sibylline networks and walled sanctuaries, an abstract kaleidoscope of silk, leather, chest, chairs, lamps, glass, mosaics, and marquetry, all circulating on the railways, a composite hologram of the great economic hubs of the Near East and North Africa since the 19th century, when Syrian art was being produced in Morocco and Moroccan art was produced in Lebanon, and so on and so forth. Another railway-driven activity of the Tarazi dynasty, who was to become the first large-scale producers of postcards from all the cities mentioned so far. Among the different trends of postcards produced by Dimitri Tarazi and son, and later by André Terzis and son, urban and country landscapes are particularly valued by tourists and collectors, image dwellers. They present the main touristic destinations of Beirut, Damascus, and Jerusalem, the secondary cities of archaeological attraction like Tripoli, Palmyre, Jaffa, Smyrna, Baalbek, and to smaller cities and villages. For instance, here, the multiple or at least the four different photographic views on the Mount of Olives, Jerusalem, expresses the impossibility to render one image or one ideal landscape in favor of the movement and travel implied within the operation of visual capture, potentially by train. These landscape postcards are particularly interesting in that they provide a debate, a room for debate, with Elias Sambar's comment on the role of photography in Palestine, 19th century. He speaks of staging devices and tricks by the British colonizer and photographer in the symbolic shaping of an idealized Holy Land, which requires the disappearance of the Palestinians themselves from the visual field. One can take example of this highly romanticized, fantasized, or fetishistic landscape, a visual commodity with high exchange value when the cliché is soft enough to be reproduced from photography to engravings and from illustrated books to artistic plates. A photograph by Frank Mason Good, an active Orientalist reporter of the 19th century, part of the Honorable London Photographic Society, and a supporter of the pre-Raphaelite aesthetic and lens. The least of his romanticizing appeal for traveling to photography places like Egypt, Constantinople, and the Holy Land of Palestine, where a tree becomes legendary as a matter of subtle staging and dramatization, to be presented as the tree where Judas hanged himself, printed in an album entitled The Life of Christ. The Ottoman railways were also vectors for that kind of colonial visual culture based on land exploitation and religious simulacrum. But if we come back to the Tarazi house-made postcards, by example of the Mount of Olives on multiple views, it is worth observing that we are neither in a scheming landscape view or penetrating pictorial scene, nor in a fully aerial view aiming at a perfect division of lines and military control. We are actually neither in a landline scale nor in a skyline scale, but somehow at an intermediary scale, allowing for a subjectivized landscape, sometimes reintroducing the Palestinian at the forefront in a position to embrace the landscape, embrace the land as a human lighthouse, and relay on the position of the image observer, us. A subjectivizing visual device close to what is called a bird's eye view, based on dialectics of inside and outside the city, and also on phenomenology of speed and industrialization, with no better emblem to endorse than the railways. A shift from the railway's bird's eye view to the aerial plane view in a post-railway period is Latif Al-Ani, who embodies the ground for documentary photography in Iraq, actually combining street photography and aerial practice as means provided by his commitment to the oil company, his employer. So Latif is on the left in a plane, and on the right is a German landscape. Is the fleeting resemblance between two photographs taken 4 years apart on the left of the Al-Sahra roundabout in Baghdad's Khadimiyya, 1961, and on the right of the Alexanderplatz in Berlin, 1965, both photographed by Latif Al-Ani? Is that resemblance or déjà vu sensation accentuated because they are both taken from above? Is it the result of chance or the fluttering of the eyelids? Or the aesthetic homogenization inherited from black and white photography? Or better, does it reveal the dynamics of pre-globalization at play, at least since the construction of the Berlin-Baghdad railway line in the early 20th century, and known to have played a major role in the outbreak of the First World War? A symbol of Iraqi, pan-Arab, and even intercontinental cosmopolitanism, Latif Al-Ani should be considered the worthy heir of Evliya Çelebi, a great 17th century Ottoman Empire traveler, and Ahmed Zaki, an Egyptian scholar who wrote poignant stories about an Oriental wandering through the Paris Universal Exhibition, 1900. Al-Ani's strong interest in the coexistence of the new and the old seems to echo his fellow visual artist approach, Jawad Selim. Latif, as a master of photographic composition, produced architectural perspectives and acrobatic angles of view that formed harmonious, near-perfect geometric lines. His kaleidoscopic eye seemed to attribute to architecture the role of interface between the archaeological view and the modern view. Al-Ani's lens stresses these formal structures produced in series, presenting architecture and design with a minimalist or even futuristic aesthetic, as in the infinite rows of identical new houses in the Yarmouk district of Baghdad, to better juxtapose them with the sacred gates of archaeological sites or old houses without appearing order, like in Agra, Nineveh. Sometimes the old and the new juxtapose in the same image, as in the left photograph of Shorja Street, where two perfectly anachronistic styles stand side by side, the 14th century Mirjan Mosque, and on the right side of the left photograph, and the white cylindrical Aboud Tower on the center of the left photograph, designed by avant-garde architects Abdullah Ihsan Kamil and Rifat Shadirji in 1955. This new aesthetic, borrowing from the Bauhaus school and Le Corbusier, can also be seen in the housing blocks built over time on both shores of the Tigris as the city gained ground on the river and its millennial history. You can see those modern buildings on the right side of the right photograph around the Tigris. Al-Ani documented both the great works on its banks and the aspiration of these avant-garde architects to find a true neo-vernacular language. One should study more in depth railway encounters of Iraqi artists and architects, such as Mohamed Makia and Jawad Salim encounter with German and American architects Walter Gropius and Frank Lloyd Wright. Here you have Mohammed Makia and Frank Lloyd Wright in discussion in Baghdad. As a conclusion, I would like to stress the terms in which, to my view, artists and cultural activists, either like Gebran Tarazi or like Latif Al-Ani, inspired me to oppose the cosmopolitan to the multicultural. Actually, facing the semantic poverty and the neoliberal exploitation of the multicultural, the cosmopolitan is based on the Greek cosmos, the universe, and polites, the citizen, or polis, the city. The cosmopolitan represents a blend concrete of the being somewhere else and the being here, the celebration of a world without boundaries, but with the dream or secret dream to find your homeland in another place than home. While the multicultural nourishes with preconceived ideas and presidential storytellings, the cosmopolitan cultivates its Nietzschean gay savoir, its puzzle of heterogeneous knowledge resolved in a series of geometric figures where one should install its Bibliothèque de Babel or its paper museum. The art of reading within secret geometries in the coffee, or in distant spirals from place to place, from outlines to detour. To sum it up, I would say the multicultural is the one who takes the world for his city, as if he could feel at home anywhere, while the cosmopolitan, to the contrary, takes his city for the world. The cosmopolitan is the one who actually activates and measures the distance separating a political tract than a train ticket, both close and at a distance. The cosmopolitan identifies with the cosmopolitic images of a film by Tariq Teghia, the Algerian filmmaker, with his last film, Révolution Zenge, from 2013, where Tariq Teghia, in his own fashion, draws an invisible line between Algeria, Greece, Lebanon, Iraq, the United States, and the Abbasid Caliphate, or a scenario for a film that was not made by Pier Paolo Pasolini, actually for a film on the life of Saint Paul, but transposed anachronistically in the modern cities of New York, Paris, and Rome. It is true, though, in order to be at the avant-garde of cartographic coincidence and other planets' alignments, that the cosmopolitan must take the risk, after a long journey and a short nap, to wake up in a land of déjà vu, and to wake up in a country or a city already visited, which I think is closer to the train experience than the plane experience. Thank you very much.